I promise to give her the decision, and this promise cannot be violated. But Indra does not deserve to be killed. In these circumstances, the solution I have is quite suitable. Purport by His Divine Grace, Sri Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Kashyapa Muni concluded, quote, Diti is eager to have a son who can kill Indra, since she is a woman, after all, and is not very intelligent. I shall train her in such a way that instead of always thinking of how to kill Indra, she will become a Vaishnavi, a devotee of Krishna. If she agrees to follow the rules and regulations, the Vaishnava principles, the unclean core of her heart will certainly be cleansed. Unquote. Chetodarpana Marjana. This is the process of devotional service. Anyone can be purified by following the principles of devotional service and Krishna consciousness. For Krishna consciousness is so powerful that it can purify even the dirtiest class of men and transform them into the topmost Vaishnavas. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement aims at this purpose. Narottam Das Thakur says, Rajendra Nandanaya Satya Sutta Harasa Balaram Halo Nitai. The appearance of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in this Kali Yuga is especially meant to deliver the fallen souls who are always planning something for material enjoyment. He gave the people in this age the advantage of being able to chant the Hare Krishna mantra and thus become fully pure, free from all material contamination. One who becomes a pure Vaishnava transcends all material conceptions of life. Thus Kashyapa Muni tried to transform his wife into a Vaishnavi so that she might give up the idea of killing Indra. He wanted that both her and her sons be purified so that they would be fit to become pure Vaishnavas. Of course, sometimes the practitioner deviates from the Vaishnava principles and there is a chance that he may fall down. But Kashyapa Muni thought that even if one falls while practicing the Vaishnava principle, he is still not a loser. Even a fallen Vaishnava is eligible for better results, as confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. Svapamapyasya dharmasya traite mahato bhagavat bhayat. Even practicing the Vaishnava principles to a small extent can save one from the greatest danger of material existence. Thus Kashyapa Muni planned to instruct his wife Diti to become a Vaishnavi because he wanted to save the life of Indra. Translation again. This is Kashyapa Muni's thoughts upon hearing the benediction, the ghastly benediction his wife wanted. I promised to give her a benediction, and this promise cannot be violated. But Indra does not deserve to be killed. In these circumstances, the solution I have is quite suitable. This chapter about the way that Diti, by her apparently very loving service to her husband, evoked his promise to fulfill her desires, and then hearing her express the motive in serving and pleasing in that way, he was mortified that her desire was to have a son who would kill Indra. So, contemplating that he could not violate his promise, it had to be fulfilled. But he had to protect her and himself, and ideally, even the children, child, but it turned out to be plural, she desired, from being implicated in this ghastly offense, because Indra is not just a powerful demigod. He is, after all, a great devotee. He teaches us in so many ways by making so many mistakes, but that's not to his discredit. It's to prevent us from having to suffer similar consequences for similar results of pride, which is so prone to follow such a high position and great power and tremendous opulence. And as a Vaishnava, even though he makes many mistakes, Indra, he always comes back to the devotional service of the Lord, and therefore is a great teacher, is a great example to emulate in his always coming back to the service of Krishna, even when he deviates and falls in many ways. And is thus a precious teacher for us to honor and venerate and learn so many things to do as well as what not to do on the path of bhakti. So Kashyapa Muni was in a great dilemma. He promised to fulfill the desire of his wife, assuming that it was something desirable, and then hearing her inner motive, devised a plan by which everyone would benefit eternally, even if there were some discrepancies or fall downs along the path. So this is a story of an individual in a time long ago in a land far away. But it's also a story about each and every one of us here and now. It's a lesson on how to approach the worship of Krishna and seek his pleasure and blessings, even though we may be harboring so many selfish desires and improper motives, which are detrimental to ourselves, to our family, to our loved ones, to our Lord, and to the path of bhakti. But in this chapter, we see the wonderful redemptive potency of the path of bhakti, because bhakti is the Lord's purest form of his internal potency, the goddess of devotion, the Lord's own, the most pure essence of the Lord's internal potency, which is so powerful that even brings Krishna under her control. So pure is the love in the goddess of bhakti, that even Krishna himself succumbs to her will. So what to speak of the purifying effects the power of bhakti has on the individual jivas who are seeking to become purified. So this example of Diti is meant to help us on the path of seeking the deepest fulfillments of our heart's desires. So, hearing her desire, Kashyapa Muni said, if you follow this vow, and he gave her a vow to follow for a year, in adhering to the Vaishnava principles, and ultimately that vow was meant to please the Supreme Lord Narayana and his internal energy, Lakshmi, by so many rules and regulations. And during that year, there was a lot of fear coming out. Indra came to serve his aunt Diti in disguise, and he was serving her so faithfully, apparently with so much love and devotion. But his motive was to find a discrepancy in her worship so that he could take advantage of that shortcoming to kill the child in her womb. And he was so fearful for that year because she was so strict in her following of the vow because of her motive to kill Indra. Whereas Kashyapa Muni was saying, all this time being very detached and very faithful, that whatever happens, the process of devotional service is eternal. The benefits of devotional service are eternal. The faults and failings of the jivas and all the horrendous consequences they bring are temporary in terms of the larger picture. So oftentimes we get so caught up in our own fears and failures and desires and motives that we lose sight of the larger picture. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is so illuminating because it covers all ages and all prominent devotees of all the ages, and how in the end, by Krishna's mercy, they were successful in overcoming all obstacles and impediments, which really arise only from our own attachments and egotistic desires. Krishna works and he desires the upliftment of the whole. The living entity, due to the initial contamination of false ego, is so prone to think only of himself that he misses the ultimate story of God's love and his eternal yearning for the return of his lost children. So Krishna gives us experience of family life and family affection, and he shows in his own pastimes how he cherishes a domestic role in loving relationships with his servants. And like a loving father who finds joy in and through his children and is always attentive to their well-being and inasmuch as they don't challenge his love and joy and agree to submit to the larger picture of loving relationships, then the whole family flourishes by rendering service to the whole. But by the madness of the effect of envy, even the supreme loving father, Sri Krishna, is challenged with being cruel and so heartless as to allow the sufferings which plague the living entities in this world. And as ungrateful children, we challenge his right and his superiority to do as he sees best. And we charge him with so many senseless accusations. And yet we see all around by the cycle of seasons and the bounty of the world how he's always providing for our legitimate necessities. And above and beyond that, he's always sending to this world, like the infinite stars in the sky, the venerable saints who try to purify our hearts, bring some darkness and some light, some guidance, some illumination into our darkened hearts and guide us back to the fulfillment of all our desires. And by the infinite arrangement and all the expressions of his love and kindness in this world, Krishna is treating the rebellious souls with small doses of suffering to try and redirect our misguided motives from harming us. So Srila Prabhupada is quoting Srila Narottam Das Thakur in his purport as far as the epitome of the Lord's mercy, that he has given us the holy name. The holy name of Krishna, the personal form of Krishna to worship, which is usually only awarded to the very most purified followers of our Arnashram Dharma. But seeing that the Kali Yuga would be so troublesome, the Lord, out of his infinite kindness, love, and mercy, made an exception to his ordinary rule. As Krishna says, I never manifest to the foolish and unintelligent, but hide behind my curtain of yoga maya. It's interesting here. He uses yoga maya as a curtain which he hides behind. Because yoga maya is the internal energy of the Lord, which affects the union of the individual soul with Krishna. And here Krishna is saying, I hide behind that curtain from the assaults of the foolish and unintelligent, rebellious souls. So that curtain of yoga maya is the internal energy of the Lord, which has alternate features in regards to our own motives of how we want to surrender and serve the Lord or rebel and revolt against the supremacy. In that way, the world just we see the world according to our own motives. The external energy is meant to protect the devotees in their intimate loving dealings with the Lord by keeping the spiritual world so pure and so selfless that the conditioned souls remained bewitched by the external energy, which is really just a different feature of the internal energy. But the feature that the energy of the Lord reveals to us is according to our own desire. So the internal energy of the Lord initially enlightens with realization of Vasudeva, who dispels all the darkness and doubts in the heart of the individual. But then even that internal energy of the Lord proceeds to bewilder the living entities into believing and feeling and realizing that they have an intimate relationship with Krishna. You see, the Bhakti Lata Bija, the seed of devotion, is planted in the heart of the jiva by the arrangement of the infinite mercy of Krishna. By the mercy of Krishna, we receive Guru. And by the mercy of Guru, we receive Krishna. And together, they're working in our lives and our hearts to plant that seed of bhakti, which is nurtured by Shravanam Kirtanam. And by that nourishing process, that bhakti lata bija, likened to a creeper, begins to grow. But a creeper has no separate existence. It seeks the shelter of a tree. So it starts growing and searching and wandering and yearning for that tree. It's not to be found in the material world. So it comes to the Viraja River, Brahmaloka, where the three modes of material nature are in actual harmony and is very purifying. But there's still no shelter there, because where's the tree which the creeper wants to climb upon, seeking the fruits of its fulfillment, crossing beyond the Viraja, beyond Brahmaloka, it comes to Vaikuntha. and has the option of 2.5 rasas of loving relationship with Krishna. Passive reverence, servitude, and 0.5 rasa of friendship. But in Vaikuntha, the rasa of Sakya is considered only half, because it cannot proceed beyond the barrier of reverence. It cannot proceed into the sweet intimacy of confidential love. And some jivas are satisfied there, but others are not. And that bhakti lata bija is still yearning, still hankering, finding dissatisfaction even in the realm of Vaikuntha, proceeds further, seeking its ultimate fulfillment. Because what is the jiva really doing? What is the mind doing when it gets us in so much trouble? It's just seeking fulfillment. But it's not to be found in this world. The ultimate fulfillment is found only at the lotus feet of Krishna, where that bhakti lata bija, embracing those lotus feet of Krishna and climbing upon that wish-fulfilling tree of Krishna's holy name and pastimes, finds the fruit for which it's ever yearning in the form of love of God. Harinam Chintamani. And then the creeper itself begins to manifest its own fruits in the form of compassion, which is manifest in preaching and distributing that same gift to others. In that holy land where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave birth to this Nam Sankirtan movement, there is a forest of wish-fulfilling trees named Belkakur. It's actually non-different from Dovavan of Braj. And long ago, a group of Shiva bhaktas were worshipping Lord Shiva there with the fruits of his favorite tree, the Bel tree. And at the culmination of their worship, Lord Shiva appeared to them and blessed them with the fulfillment of their various desires. But one of those devotees, Nimbaditta, who had been especially attentive in his worship of Lord Shiva, told him that you should go further in your quest. And nearby, in the same forest, your gurus are wrapped in meditation on the lotus feet of Krishna. And by serving them, you will attain all which is of value. So following the directions given by Lord Shiva, Nimbaditta he followed the illumination of the forest and found on a raised platform the four Kumaras wrapped in meditation. Very effulgent, very young, very noble in character, and completely naked. And just so beautiful was the manifestation of the love in their countenance. He got so excited. He shouted, Hare Krishna! And that broke their meditation. And they opened their eyes and were so happy to see such a perfect candidate for the mercy of the Lord before them as Nimbaditta. And they all ran and embraced him one by one. And then Sanat Kumar explained to Nimbaditta that the Supreme Lord, seeing that this Kali Yuga would be especially troublesome, empowered four great souls to preach. Lakshmi empowered Ramanuja. Brahma empowered Madhva. Rudra empowered Vishnu Swami. And it is our great delight to instruct you, us four Kumaras who were previously absorbed in that sinful desire of absorption in Brahman, have been relieved from that offense, that obstacle, and elevated to the sweetness of the path of bhakti. And then Sanat Kumar told him to bathe in the holy Ganges and come back, and he would impart to him the Radha Krishna mantra and the sentiments of love, Bhava Marg. So, bathing in the river, coming back, taking initiation, worshipping Radha and Krishna by the mantra imparted by Sanat Kumar, at the fulfillment, at the completion, at the perfection of his worship, the Supreme Lord, Sri Sri Radha Vrindavan Chanda, appeared there in that forest, the Bail Pakur, illuminating all directions with their effulgence. And Nimbatitya just fell prostrate, offering his prayers. And then, as Radha Krishna spoke to him, they're revealing their pleasure at his worship with great love and devotion. They revealed that in the Kali Yuga, they would combine as one form. And there, before his eyes, Radha and Krishna merged into the form of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And I've never seen such a form of the Lord as this. And then Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told them that I will appear in the Kali Yuga to preach. And Nimbaditya was feeling, I want to preach and tell everyone about you. He said, no, you can't do that now. You can only preach the pastimes of Radha and Krishna and the path of bhakti. And I reside happily in those topics. When my lila is manifest in the future, you will take birth again. And you will be famous throughout the land as the Digvijaya Keshava, or Keshava Karshana, the conqueror of all directions. And by the mercy of Saraswati, you will have a benediction that whatever you speak, all the Vedic truths will be manifest from your tongue. And therefore, you will be undefeatable. No mortal being will have the power, the knowledge to defeat you. And you will just traverse the land, happily conquering all opponents. And then finally, as the fulfillment of the blessing of Saraswati, you will meet one very young, apparently arrogant pandit in Avadvaita Dham, and you will be defeated, not by any mortal being, but by me in my childhood pastimes. And then, by the mercy of Saraswati, by the ultimate fulfillment of her benediction, you will give up all pride and take shelter at my lotus feet. So, and then you will preach the philosophy, Dvaita Dvaita. And then the Lord revealed to him that after that, I will myself take up the preaching. And I will take from the four foundry acharyas two essential teachings. From Madhva, I will accept his strong philosophy to defeat the Mayavadis and his teachings of the worship of the deity as an eternal entity. And from Ramanuj, I will take bhakti, pure bhakti, free from karma again, in service to the devotees. From Vishnuswami, exclusive dependence on Sri Krishna and the path of Radha Bhakti. And from you, I will take back two of the essential teachings which I have imparted unto you, the necessity of shelter at the lotus feet of Srimati Radharani, and the high esteem for the gopi's sacrifice and surrender and most pure service to Krishna. So, Nimbaditya, so eager to preach, but told that he could not reveal the upcoming appearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu at that time, preached Dvaita Dvaita, very eager, and pastimes of Radha and Krishna. Eager for the time when he would take birth again as the great pundit, the conqueror of all directions, Keshava Kashmiri. So Keshava Kashmiri, as we know from Chaitanya Charitamrita, traveled to all the centers of learning in Bharatvarsha. And he had a great reputation that wherever he came, he would defeat the greatest scholars in the six branches of Vedic knowledge, of which only one is Vedanta. And the etiquette at that time was a conquering, a pundit who was defeated had to surrender to his victor. So, conquering all these great pundits, Keshava Kashmiri had an incredible entourage of elephants, horses, chariots, and this huge wagon on which he piled all his certificates of defeat. Because whenever he defeated the pundit, he made him sign a certificate. You surrendered to me. And therefore, that mountain of signing certificates was just like symbolic of the mountain of pride that usually goes along with scholasticism. So he conquered all the great centers of learning, all the university towns, all the pundits, all the professors in Bharatvarsha, just as preparation for his victorious march into Navadvip Dham, which was the emporium of all learning and culture of the world. And when the word preceded him that the Digvijaya Pandit, the conqueror of all directions, was coming, normally the pundits of Nadia would not be in the least intimidated from the Digvijaya Pandit from afar. The problem is that they were so covetous of the benedictions of Saraswati, but they knew that he was her favorite chosen son who had given him the benediction that he could not be defeated by any mortal being. And the pundits realized that they were going to have to sign the certificates. And they could not bear the humiliation. So they just became so wracked in fear that they couldn't even teach their disciples. And they were just thinking, what are we going to do? Where can we find the pundit who will preserve our dignity? And then when the students of Nimai Pandit came and told him that the whole city is wrapped in fear because of the victorious march approaching our city of the whole entourage of the Digvijaya Pandit, and everyone was so terrorized, they were amazed that Nimai Pandit, the young teenage professor of beginner's grammar, who had also become a professor while he was still a student, began to smile. And he was obviously contemplating something deep within himself, which nobody could understand. How can he be so calm when our whole city is facing disgrace and ruination and the conquest of this Digvijaya Pandit? And then the Lord, that night, when he was instructing his students on the bank of the Ganges on the shore, and he saw that they were still so intimidated, he said, a tree which is heavily laden with the most valuable fruits does not stand high in pride, but naturally bows down in humility and reverence. So, what do we have to fear from the pride of this Digvijaya Pandit? Have you not heard throughout the history of the world how Krishna, he doesn't like pride and ego, and he always invariably brings it down. Have you not heard the story of all the great conquerors of the world, Haihayana, Shusha, and all the rest? Krishna invariably brings down that pride and ego in the hearts of its living entities because it's so displeasing to him. And it's just disastrous for the jivas themselves. Because it creates a whole illusory world. A world based on their own selfish pleasure, where they themselves are the center, which in reality cannot exist. Krishna is like the sun. The jivas are just like the rays from the sun. They have no independent existence. Krishna is glorified as being holy, which is the roots of holistic and wholesome. He's concerned with the welfare of the whole, everyone, each and every part and parcel. And when the part and parcel begins thinking of himself exclusively, just to honor the free will, which is prerequisite to love, Krishna awards him the option of expressing and realizing the fruits of their free will in the material world, in which living entities come together and make coalitions based on similar desires and expressing their... But it's all temporary, because the three modes are always in competition. And whatever allegiances the jivas make for some temporal satisfaction, it's going to change, and the best friends become worst enemies, and the worst enemies become the best of friends. Anyway, when the Lord was instructing him, and it was a beautiful full moon night, and the rays of the beautiful moon over Nadi were reflected by the endless waves of the flowing Ganges, who dressed herself in a most graceful feature that night. And then as the Lord was very nonchalantly instructing his students, the dreaded arrival of the Divijaya Pandit, right in the middle of class. And the Divijaya Pandit, he offered his obeisances and prayers to the holy Ganges, and he looked at this assembly of students of beginner's grammar. And for the first time in his life, he felt a kind of reverence and a little bit of fear in his heart. But the Lord, seeing him, invited him, "Please take your seat." And Divijaya Pandit came kind of nervously, and he asked, "Is he?" "Oh yes, he is indeed the great Nimaya Nadi. Please take your seat." So he was feeling a little fearful. He never felt intimidated before. "What is this?" And he said, "So you're the great Nimaya Nadi. I've heard that you're a great professor of beginner's grammar." And the Lord said, "Probably just exaggeration. I can't even really very well understand the beginner's grammar. But you, we've all heard about you. You're such a great pundit. And if you could bless us with your recitation of the glories of the holy Ganges, who descends from the toe of Lord Ramana, and flows throughout the material realm to purify the hearts of all conditioned souls. If we could hear a recitation of your propounding the glories of the holy Ganges, that would wash away the sins in our hearts and we would all be uplifted." And the Divijaya Pandit said, "Yes." And he proceeded to compose spontaneous Sanskrit verses in the praise of the holy Ganges, which was so eloquent that it was like a continuous roll of thunder from the clouds and just held everyone spellbound in rapt adoration. And the students were just saying, "Ram, Ram, this is phenomenal. His words are so eloquent and so rich with shining similes and mystical metaphors and eloquent allegories," which they couldn't even follow. But they all knew for sure that they had never heard or experienced or seen such an exhibition of erudite scholarship as this. And after 3 hours, when that continuous roll of spontaneous Sanskrit verses, so poetical, so rhythmic, perfect bride and reader came to a culmination, and everybody was just spellbound and speechless in adoration, and were saying amongst themselves, "Who is this Devijaya Pandit? It appears as if Saraswati herself has appeared on his tongue." And it was true. And then me, my pundit, responded, "That was wonderful. And we would like to hear a continuation of the glories of your recitation. If you could just explain the faults in that one verse." And then he recited one of the verses, which impressed the Devijaya Pandit. "No one can understand my verses. How could you even have grasped one in your memory?" "Well, by the grace of Saraswati, one may be a great orator like yourself, and one like me just may have a good memory. So I also have a little mercy from Saraswati, so I remember your verses. But the thing I don't really understand, I needed to hear from you, is would you please explain the three mistakes in this, just one verse, the three mistakes?" And he recited, and he explained, "You made three mistakes in that one verse." And the Devijaya Pandit was amazed. No one in the world has ever been able to really fully appreciate or understand my verses. But nobody ever imagined finding faults in my verses. And I never imagined anybody finding faults in my verses. But that's all right, Nimai encouraged them. Even the greatest pundits, even the greatest of all mortal beings, they have their faults. It's nothing to be discouraged about. So just please explain what you meant by making those mistakes. So he encouraged it. And the Devijaya Pandit tried to explain. He tried to rationalize his mistakes, but Nimai Pandit, every rationalization he made, he kept finding more mistakes in his explanation. And he said, "Well, you know, actually, if you look deeply, we'll find infinite mistakes in your poetry." Devijaya Pandit said, "Who is this boy?" And he said, "Oh, that's all right. You must be tired after such a display, after such a presentation, after such a show. So just go back to your lodge and take rest, and we can continue tomorrow." And then Nimai's students, they began to laugh, because everybody likes, every conditioned soul likes to see the humiliation of some other proud person. They don't like to see them themselves, but they like to see them. So they start, and no. He maintained the respect for the pride and the dignity of this Devijaya Pandit. And then the pandit went back to his room in his lodge, and his mind was just reeling. What is going on? How can this be when the benediction is of the gods themselves to be uncertain? Who is this boy? And Saraswati, why have you forsaken me? And when he was reciting her prayer, her mantra, and his mind was so deeply troubled and tormented, toward the end of the night, he fell into a slumber. And Saraswati herself appeared to him, illuminating all the darkness in his heart and revealing the fulfillment of her benediction. She said, "The benediction I gave you was meant to go way beyond becoming a conqueror of this world. That would have been a totally vain benediction from me, because that boy pundit you met today is my Lord and Master. He is the Lord of all the endless universes. He is the source of all the avatars, like Lord Nishina, Akil, Hiranyakashipu, to give pleasure to Allah. He is the source of that Varaha who lifted the earth out of the depths of darkness and placed her back in orbit as a demonstration of how he would appear to lift the world out of the depths of ignorance in his golden appearance as Mahaprabhu. You today have met the Lord who is my master. But you always like to manipulate my words. You like to use my benediction to confront others. But my benediction, my words, will never be used to confront him. Because he is my master, I am his eternal maidservant. So now you have finally achieved the fruit of chanting my mantra, the fruit of all knowledge, the fruit of all everything is to surrender with utmost humility at his lotus feet. Because it is really the Sankirtan movement, which is the life and soul of all transcendental knowledge. And go beg that benediction from him. And he said, don't consider this to be a vain, ordinary dream. This is my true darshan and benediction to you. So the Digri Jayabhagat awoke in the morning. It was already morning. And he ran and fell prostrate at the lotus feet of Nimai Pandit. And the young professor, seeing some humble soul falling at his feet, picked him up and embraced him and said, it's you! And he got totally embarrassed. What are you doing, you great world conqueror, falling at the feet of this mere student of beginner's grammar? And Digri Jayabhagat said, don't try to bewilder me with those words. I know who you are. Saraswati revealed it to me this very night. And then the prayers which ensued from the depths of the heart of the Digri Jayabhagat are so illuminating as the fulfillment of all wisdom. And just to condense it into one very essential verse, the Digri Jayabhagat said, aside from what Saraswati told me, and I was supposed to keep confidential, was the fact that even though you defeated me 3 times, you won over my heart. I am the Digri Jayabhagat, the conqueror of all the pundits in all directions, the conqueror of all the university cities. But you won over the realm of my heart. You defeated me 3 times in public debate. But you preserved my dignity and honor and my spirit. No one but the Lord could do that. And therefore, I'm coming to surrender to you as a fulfillment of all my benedictions from Saraswati. Because you always bless the helpless surrendered souls with your deepest compassion and mercy. And then when the Lord embraced him, the Lord's touch completed the purification of his heart. And by that touch, renunciation as the inseparable companion of true wisdom appeared in the heart of the Digri Jayabhagat. And he went back to his entourage of so many servants and maidservants and horses and chariots and elephants and that big wagon with that big pile of signed certificates of defeat. And he just distributed it all to the poor and the needy. And he went off into the forest as a sannyasi. And the Lord had so much infused his heart with devotion, and all he wanted was to distribute the gift of transcendental knowledge. But the Lord told him, you can't tell anybody about this yet. You just preach. Dvaita, dvaita. And the Lord told him that, and the Lord did. It wasn't quite that time, but later on, after taking his initiation from Ishvara Puri in Bihar, the Lord himself, he did what he told Nibbaditya in that previous darshan. He took the essential teachings of all the 4 foundry acharyas. Those 4 foundry acharyas are like the first stars rising on the horizon as forerunners of the golden moon of Vaidarbha. So, what we have to do when we get too isolated in our own stories of despair and defeat, is realizing and questioning, why is the Lord not responding? Why is he so cruel? Why is he waiting? I'm begging for his mercy. Where is it? You've got to understand, he's trying to take our own little stories of sorrow and pain and lift them into a larger story of sorrow and pain, in which great joy, in which great fulfillment is hidden. And therefore, preaching is the essential duty of one who acts, because preaching means sharing the mercy, distributing the compassion which we received as the gift of Guru and Brahma. So, Keshava Kashmir, he became a sannyasi. He just went out, but the Lord told him, you can't tell anybody about me yet. Preach pastime, talk of it, distribute that Krishna Katha, the pastimes of Radha and Krishna, because I delight, I reside in those holy topics. As the gopis themselves said, when just a little drop of Krishna Katha enters one's ears, if the heart, if the portals to the heart are the least bit open, by the slightest tinge of humility, that Krishna Katha goes right into the heart. And it conquers the realm of the heart. And it makes that person so disinterested in anything of this world, tasting the slightest tinge of that utmost satisfaction of Krishna Katha. And what is it about Krishna Katha? When we're submissive, and we show a little inclination and eagerness, the Lord, in that form of transcendental sound, he enters our hearts, and he himself takes upon himself the cleansing process. All those anarthas which darken our hearts and are so impossible. Our own anarthas, which we have created by our own false ego, has created a barrier, a wall, which keeps us in prison in the material world. It's impossible for us to escape the prison which by our own misuse of the free will, the Lord has given us for the sake of love. We've imprisoned ourselves in walls so fortified that it is beyond our ability to escape. But there is a means. Krishna himself appeared in the dungeon in the prison of Kamsa to free his devotees when shackled there, as a testimony to what he'll do for us. When we show the slightest inclination to Krishna Katha by some humility and some eagerness, Krishna, who lives in that Katha, we're associating with his pastimes through the process of hearing. There's no difference. The process of Krishna consciousness is absolute. Everything about Krishna's his pastimes are absolute. You're participating, you're entering those pastimes by the process of hearing. And Krishna, to help us, takes upon himself the cleansing process. How can Krishna, the most pure, enter into the deepest darkness of the rebellious jiva's hearts? Because he's the most humble. He's the most merciful. And when we show the slightest inclination to love him, he shows his infinite inclination to love us and reciprocate unlimitedly our slightest eagerness and humility in approaching him. So in this chapter, you see a little bit of the larger picture. What is the larger picture in this little episode of the romance, and when Diti was so plagued with lusty desires that she implored her husband for union, but it was the wrong time, and it was the wrong motive, and they got these two demon sons, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, and they were delivered by the lords in the form of Nrisimha and Varaha, and Diti was thinking, that rascal Indra, he made Krishna violate his promise to be impartial, and he killed my son, so Indra needs to be killed. So she pleased her husband with such apparent loving service, and he said, oh, I'm so pleased by your service, I'll give you whatever you want, a son to kill Indra.
Kashyap at all.
No. Now we're all going to be implicated. What to do? You turn to Krishna. The process of devotion. If you fulfill this vow, 1 year strictly worshiping Krishna by this Vaishnava etiquette, all your desires will be fulfilled. How were her desires fulfilled? Toward the end of the year, she fell asleep because she was so exhausted from all the tapasya. Indra entered her womb, and with his thunderbolt, that shining embryo who was becoming so purified by his mother's tapasya and service, shining, brilliant, like gold, Indra hacked it into 7 pieces. But then the embryo became 7. And Indra cut each one into 7 pieces. There was 49. More brilliant, more effulgent, more of them. And they began pleading with Indra, "We're your brothers. Why are you killing us?" And then he realized that Titi wasn't going to get a son who was going to kill him. She got 49 sons who were his servants, his brothers, his friends. And then she woke up and found that she wanted one son. She got 49. She wanted one to kill Indra, but she was so satisfied in finding that her 49 sons were the best of friends with Indra. And then they all went to heaven. And it was so wonderful that that's how this whole chapter begins. And Maharaj Parikshit heard from Shukadeva Goswami that Diti, who generally gives birth to demons, gave birth to 49 demigods. How? What happened? He knew it was something about Krishna. He was too wonderful to be anything. And he was eager to hear. And Shukadeva was eager. But really, what is it? It's a lesson in how when you get so, you know, the false ego is so insidious. It'll do anything to be the center. Even if my suffering and my anguish and my ordeals keeps me in the center, then bring them on. And then, why are you suffering? Just let it go. But letting it go means letting Krishna, letting Guru, put it forth. Because, you know, what does the Vaishnava do? He doesn't just come and soothe away the pain. He deepens it. Because pain deepened can be pain shared. And pain shared is pain redeemed. And he also, of course, Krishna was very tricky. Prabhupada said, just chant Hare Krishna and be happy. He didn't tell us, yes, that came later. How Krishna, you know, reciprocate. Krishna's tricky. It's a good thing he's tricky. We worship a thief. Why? Because we're so attached to our sufferings and our false ego that it would take the best thief to relieve us. But what does he do? And what does the guru? He takes our own little stories of suffering and pain and he deepens it. We didn't want that. That wasn't part of our initial agreement and vow. But Krishna's tricky. Because pain deepened can be pain shared. Everybody in this world is suffering. Don't get wrapped up in your own, the conditioned soul will become, he'll make an indulgence of his own suffering. Then why am I suffering? Oh, why am I so indulging in it? So the guru, he deepens it because he allows you to actually look at what's in the depths of your heart. Oh, no. But it's not, it's every conditioned soul. And then he takes our own fragmented stories of suffering and pain and lifts it into a larger story and context of suffering and pain. The whole material world is just an endless flow of suffering and pain. That's why the oceans are made of salt water. It's the tears of the anguish of the conditioned souls that fills the oceans. So how do you get so stuck up in your own little story? Look at the world. What are you going to do? What does Krishna want? That we distribute his mercy. And then, if you look at the larger picture, what is going on here?
When Lord Nishimadeva appeared and killed Hiranyakashipu, he was roaring so furiously. And he was, you know, he was shaking his head, and his mane was cutting the clouds to pieces, throwing airplanes into orbit or out of orbit, whatever. And Brahma and Shiva, they were terrified. They wanted to offer prayers to satisfy him and pacify him. They were afraid to go anywhere near him. They asked Lakshmi, "You do it." He said, "I've never seen a form like this. I'm not going anywhere near him. What to do?" Prahlad. So Prahlad, in this just childlike, simple, innocent form, came before the Lord and fell down and offered his prayers. "I'm not afraid of your blood-soaked mane and the garland of intestines from my dear father, which are adorning your holy form. And I'm not afraid of those nails and teeth soaked with blood, because I know who you are." And then the Lord stopped roaring, and that lion just began to purr. He took him in his lap. Because what's all that roaring? It's his protection for the surrendered souls, his own children. And then everybody came and offered their prayers. Fine, it was to provide. But what is, anyway, not to get off the on this tangent, because the larger picture is, this wasn't really all about killing Hiranyakashipu. It was really, you know, to really appreciate, just go back to the fifth canto. Residents of Hari, of Hari Varsha offering their prayers, headed by Prahlad, and everyone in that Varsha joining him in his prayers, the Vaishnava prayer, "Let there be peace and harmony throughout the world, and let everyone's envy become pacified by practicing devotional service, because only that, by the potency of bhakti, will they ever think about each other's welfare. Let us all together engage in service to the supreme transcendence, and always remain absorbed in loving thoughts of him. My Lord, we pray that we may never fall into the prison of material attachment with all its bondage, but may your nails and teeth like thunderbolts destroy our demon-like desires to exploit and control and enjoy in this world, and free us from our own internal demons, so that we can be free to love, free to serve, free to take shelter at your lotus feet." That was the prayer that really inspired the appearance of Lord Nishimadeva. It wasn't the demon here on the Kashipu and the fear of the demigod. That was part of it. That was secondary. Just as a secondary effect of Diti's vow was her, she was blessed by the fulfillment of the desire way beyond her initial inspiration. She wanted a son. She got 49 who were beautiful, who were effulgent, who befriended Indra. And that made her happy beyond what her envious desires initially intended and contemplated. So her, by a secondary aspect of her vow, her desires the fulfillment of her desires excelled the desire that she could have even conceived. That was just the secondary aspect of her vow. Her service is instructed by her husband. The real fulfillment is that Diti, who was famous as the mother of the demons, became the grandmother of Prahlad Maharaj. And Lord Nishimadeva told him, and he implored the Lord, "Please forgive my father." He said, "Not only your father, 21 generations will be delivered." So...
if we really want to do, as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati told Srila Prabhupada, if you want to do good to yourself and to others, then share this message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Preach, distribute Krishna's mercy. Because as Krishna himself says, there is no one so dear, nor will there ever be anyone so dear. As he who shares this message, this holy discourse of Krishna and Arjuna, because it is filled with Krishna Katha, Krishna's holy name, which is the touchstone which fulfills all the deepest desires and yearnings of our hearts. Thank you very much. Any comments or questions? Louder, please. Yes. Well, Krishna says, those who consider themselves to be my devotees are not devotees. Those who consider themselves servants of the servants of the servants are the devotees of my heart. So it's best that we not think of ourselves as devotees. We should think of ourselves and one another as aspiring servants of the servants of the servant. Aspiring servant of the servant of the servant means there may be traces of anarthas left. And understanding the process of bhakti means that when you initially take up the process and invite, implore Krishna to come within your heart, the fight begins. Because humility also means truth, acknowledging the truth that we've come to this material world, we've taken birth here because of our envy of Krishna. From that root of envy, with its manifestation of false ego, Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyaksha, Dantavaka, Shishupal, Ravana, Kumbhakarna, are not big world demons of other ages. They're the personification of the kam, krodha, lobha, moha, madhavatsarya, which are in the hearts of all of us. And as long as you're surrendered to kam, krodha, lobha, moha, madhavatsarya, it'll pretty much leave you alone. And it'll seem so natural that you won't even know that it's there. You won't even so much see that it's there. But then, when you confront your false ego with, I don't want to be surrendered to them anymore. I want to be surrendered to Krishna and his representatives, guru and sadhus and shastra and the Vaishnavas. Then the false ego rises up like this multi-headed monster from the depths of the darkness of our heart as if it's going to devour you. Kaliya, we've just been discussing lately, is a wonderful visualization for this process of chanting Hare Krishna. But Kaliya is not alone. He's assisted in his service to Kamsa with, you know, all these demons that are always attacking Braj. They're within us all. These are not some historical figures to study from the past. They're archetypes of elements that are within all of us. When we take up the process of service to Krishna, Krishna brings them out because he wants them to be gone. And when they come out and you see them, it's not always pleasing or encouraging. Unless you know what's really going on. It's that Krishna's driving them out. So we don't see what's in the heart. Man sees what's on the outside. Krishna sees the heart. And when Krishna from within the heart drives them out, see, he won't live with them. He drives them out. And then when they begin manifesting themselves in our outward dealings, it may not be very nice.
have to understand what's going on. Of course, another thing that can be going on is that this is the age of color, which means hypocrisy. And hypocrisy is not something that can be compartmentalized into certain aspects of our life, like, I'll be hypocritical in the way that I dress, but I won't be hypocritical in the way I interact. No. Hypocrisy pervades all aspects of existence in the Kali Yuga. And it also tries to infiltrate the assembly of Vaishnavas. What to do? In the age of quarrel and hypocrisy, there's only one way. There is no other way, no other way, no other way than the chanting of the holy name, chanting of the holy name, chanting of the holy name. So, you know, we like to be in good association where everyone's kind and loving and compassionate and sweet. But sometimes Krishna sends somebody who just brings out the worst in us. Somebody is so angry that they make us angry. Wonderful Krishna. If someone comes and is just so angry that he brings out your own anger, you should thank Krishna that here's a teacher to show me where the areas where I need to work. Because, you know, we have so many personalities in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Like, you know, we discussed previously, you know, King Yadu and the Avadhut Brahman. You know, how even someone like, why? You know, 24 major gurus. But when you actually take to heart the words of a guru, you see that everyone and everything is there to instruct you. If you have the eyes to see and the ears to hear. So someone comes along who, see if I'm learning the terminology, they press your buttons, right? Means they program you to be like them. They're angry, so you get angry. You don't have to get angry, because what is anger? An acronym says it's a nasty getting even response. But you don't have to try to get even. You don't have to. You have a choice. If somebody gets angry at you and you get angry back, what have you done? You've just affirmed, yeah, it's worth getting angry about. But what does it really tell about the person's heart? What it really says is they're hurting. And why are they hurting? They think that Krishna doesn't love them. And if they don't feel like they're loved by Krishna, they can't be loving. So they're upset, they're hurting, and they respond with anger. What is that? That's a call to love. They need a demonstration of Krishna's love. We have that option too. You can get angry and confirm that, yeah, life is bad. Where is Krishna's love? Just get angry. Krishna doesn't love us. And then if you get angry and you push your buttons and you respond to the lower modes, you just affirm. Yeah, it is lousy. And then you get all caught up in your own little fears and your own little hurts and your own cynicisms and criticisms, and life looks terrible. But you have an option. If someone comes and tries to interact with you in the lower modes of passion and ignorance, you don't have to perpetuate the karma. You have the free will to cancel it then and there by a higher expression of love and compassion in yourself. And it's the person, partly the own person's own free will and depth of conditioning, how they're going to respond, but at least you've done your part. And chosen that yourself, you don't want to perpetuate the interactions of the lower modes. But you want to bring something higher in the form of the compassion of Guru and Krishna to the world. So it may be any of these things, but we always have the free will to respond lovingly anyway. And to try to see the best, even if it's not the most obvious thing in the world, it'll help to bring it out and bring it about. Anything else? Thank you.
sometimes someone comes along and like will make us angry or will like do something that really, really hurts us, and the pain can be just so deep that, you know, you're just so wrapped up in it. How, and it's very hard to see like the bigger picture, you know, when you're just like hurting so much. How can you like get over that?
Pain shared is pain healed. Rupa Goswami has given us 6 major categories of loving exchange. Revealing the mind and heart in confidence. Doesn't mean you go revealing your mind and heart to anyone. Because there's different levels of violence. We can violate others' existence by killing. We can violate the peace by suspicious thoughts. We can violate relationships by breaking confidentiality. Confidentiality fosters confidence. So, if you're hurting so much that it's becoming like an obsession, you have to reach out and share that. And when you do, you usually find out that the other person is experiencing similar conditions. And in the sharing, because Srila Rupa Goswami has given us 6 major forms of loving exchange. The loving exchange is the medium by which Krishna comes and soothes our heart with nectar. The nectar of His holy name, the nectar of His pastimes, the nectar of the relationships which brings these pastimes to life. So, yes, it's a very important reality that we're not that strong, that we can always endure the pain that we experience. Yes, we can endure it alone. But in relationships, and part of the relationship is you find out, when you confide in another, I'm really hurting, you find out the other person is too. You didn't suspect that, you thought it was all you. And you find out, it's not just me. It's everyone. And what does that do? It usually awakens a feeling of compassion, a sense of another's well-being, a concern for another's pain. And that takes the center off yourself. You know, if you don't have that kind of sharing, if you don't have that kind of relationships, then yes, you do tend to get, you know, consumed in your own thoughts, in your own pain, in your own ordeals. But when you share, and then the burden's not all on you. And it's no longer a burden when it's shared. Then it's a matter of caring relationships. And that brings in the divine element, which is healing, which is redemptive. And as I said, we'll place that pain. It won't make it just go away. It'll place it in a larger picture of a suffering world where there's a seed of hope planted in the form of the holy name, which is the means by which Krishna takes root in our hearts and nourishes the Bhaktilata Bija to find the ultimate shelter for which it's yearning. So there's a lot, all these things can be seen as a teacher guiding you where to turn, where to reach out, where to touch and be touched. So the trick in dealing with the mind is don't let the mind be your master. You know, people, you hear so often, oh, I have so much trouble with my mind. You know, it's like to get rid of it, make it go to sleep or whatever. But, you know, it's there. But what's it really doing? It's just looking for pleasure. And if it doesn't find it, it gets frustrated. Well, you gotta... The trick is, don't let your mind be your master. Train it to be your servant. It's telling you, you're a pleasure-seeking living entity. We all are. But it's not to be found in this world, pleasure. It's not to be found in sense objects. It's to be found in service. And then that pain, like everything else, can be your teacher, can be your guide. It's where to turn, where to reach out, where to touch and be touched. So relationships is what takes the center off yourself and opens up sharing and caring, which is redemptive because it's an aspect of Krishna's compassion and love.
So if somebody is actually in the middle of expressing anger toward you, and if you don't feel anger back and you do want to express compassion or understanding or love, how can you do it in such a way the person doesn't then feel like you're being, a lot of times when you try to do that, they kind of respond in getting angrier.
I'll give an example. There was a very nice man who had a very nice wife, a very nice family. But at one point, his daughter became very rebellious, and she fell into bad association and got involved in bad habits and bad intoxication, which so much altered her behavior that she was always being angry and resentful and rebellious. And it put the whole household into complete turmoil. And they were trying everything. Nothing, it just seemed to be getting worse and worse and worse until the husband just didn't know what to do. And then his daughter said, "I just need a hug." And then he hugged her and then realized that they hadn't really been relating as they should have. Well, this is symbolic for reaching out and trying to touch the person where it's needed. If you get angry, you just reinforce the whole conditioning. It's a natural response. Somebody gets angry, you defend and get angry back, and you just reinforce the whole conditioning. But even worse than that is you affirm. And what are we angry about? We're angry because we're hurting. Why are we hurting? Because we don't really believe that Krishna loves us. And if somebody gets angry, which is their way of, you know, venting that pain, and you do the same thing, you just confirm, yeah, it's true, Krishna doesn't love us. Krishna's not merciful. It's all rhetoric. But when you understand with your intelligence, that's the mind. And then by the intelligence, you guide, you know, you try to respond with higher modes. I don't wanna get stuck in this. And you by a gesture of kindness, reaching out, compassion, understanding, acceptance. Bring in the higher modes and affirm it. Yes, Krishna does love us. Krishna is merciful. Then that soothes that pain. You know, that pain doesn't want to be reinforced. It's the natural conditioning to do so. That's not what the heart wants. So we have to realize how much we're conditioned and try to elevate ourselves from the conditioning and the bondage of the lower modes to the higher modes. And understand, I'm not a computer to be programmed and have somebody pushing buttons. I just have to respond according to the modes. I'm conditioned to do that, but that's not really who and what I am. I'm really part and parcel of Krishna, servant of the servant. I'm supposed to respond. I'll give another example. There's a story. I don't know if it's historical or allegorical, and it doesn't really matter because the lesson is the same either way. When, during the French Revolution, they were just going after royalty everywhere and chopping off their heads in the guillotine. This is like a contemporary example of what's the demon in Krishna Lila who personifies, you know, disloyal controversy? Anyway, contemporary history, you got the French Revolution. Disloyal controversy, intercommunal discord. The forest fire in Braj, it's the blazing conflagration, which symbolizes what happens when there's friction amongst the factions and jivas. It blazes out into a conflagration which destroys everything. That's why Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati predicted this, Srila Prabhupada, there will be fire in the mountain, and there was. Anyway, contemporary history, got the French Revolution. And it all started the same way. you know, rumors, rumor mongering, fault finding, criticisms, culturing suspicion, which violates trust and destroys love. And finally, you know, the French Revolution was just following in the footsteps of the blazing conflagration which threatened to devour all the Brutabasis. So they were just, you know, the revolutions were just going around cutting off the heads of all royalty when it burst out in this, you know. And then they found a prince, a young boy, who was born of royalty. Taken to the guillotine. And the child was terrified. Down with the prince. And then somebody said, no! If you chop off the head of a child, he'll go to heaven. And that's too good for royalty. Give him to Meg, the wicked witch, and she'll teach him all, bad ways. And he'll go to hell. So, yeah, they like that. So they took him to Meg, the black witch, and she tried to teach him bad words and bad relationships and bad indulgences. But he wouldn't do it. No, I'm a prince. I'm not meant for that kind of stuff. It's below my dignity. He just would not comply with Meg the Wicked Witch. Well, I don't know. You know, it may be historical, but whether it's allegorical, it teaches, you know, as aspiring Vaishnavas and Vaishnavas, it's below our dignity to, not that I have anything against computers, but to, you know, identify as a computer, that somebody comes and pushes your buttons and you have to respond. Because you're not a computer. You're a jiva. Jivas have free will, which computers, nothing against computers, but they don't have free will. And you see people have, they're trying to develop loving relationships with computers. You can't do it. They don't have free will. They may do whatever you want, but there's more to free will and love than that. So you got free will. You can choose to be a computer if you want. You can choose to be a Vaishnava. You're a Vaishnava if you want. It's all based on desire. And it takes practice. Sometimes you fail and you become a computer. But then you know when you're in your, by your intelligence, no, I'm not a computer. I have free will. I don't have to get programmed by this mode to act in that moded way. I have free will. I can respond with kindness because I'm supposed to be a representative of Guru and Gauranga. And you may fail a few times. You may succeed a few times. But what is conditioning? It's like making a rope. Do you ever make a rope? You know, you take one strand, and then you take another strand, and another, and then you get a string, and then you start braiding the different strings into a rope. And sometimes, like, you know, we used to have an elephant, so we'd take three ropes and braid them into what we called an elephant rope. And sometimes in breaking bulls and mules, they'd break an elephant rope, so you have to make it stronger. But a rope or a cable is just a bunch of little threads bound together until it becomes, well, conditioning's like that. When you respond to any particular mode, it's like a thread. It's beginning to make that guna, that rope. And then we respond again, and there's two. Respond again, and there's three. Then when you get about nine, you got a strand. And then you keep, and then finally, it just becomes automatic. You are programmed by this mode to respond in this way. And therefore we have Bhagavad Gita to teach us what the different modes condition us, how the different modes condition us to respond, and then we train ourselves to immerse ourselves in higher modes, which will, you know, start creating that bond of a better kind of conditioning. And then when you get to the mode of goodness, that's next to Shuddhasattva, which is illuminating and freeing from bondage. And the real bondage we want is Krishna's love. We want to be bound and controlled to that mode, which expresses itself in humility, compassion, and service. And that's why we say, okay, we're practicing the process of devotional service, but we've been Krishna since time immemorial, so we make mistakes and we fall down sometimes. Because Shakyamuni, we see in this chapter, he knew there's going to be mistakes, there's going to be problems. The mistakes and problems are temporary manifestations of conditioned nature. The process of devotional service is eternal. So the faults and anguish we face from our shortcomings in our stage of practice, that's temporary. The results, the goal is eternal. So our goal is to be bound slaves of Krishna's mercy and be conditioned to respond to any situation with that expression.
So what is the difference when you gave, like, there's two situations where a devotee is sincerely trying to be a devotee and these anarthas come up so that they can get purified. So what's the difference when someone, how can you tell if they're doing it, if that's what's happening or if they're being hypocritical?
Well, the first, the first thing is the difference is deception. If we perform in a way, in a certain way, for the purpose of deception, we won't make any progress. We are taught to interact and behave in a certain way, you know, with respect and etiquette, and we do that because that's the way we're trained. But then, you know, you're thinking, well, this person said this, and I'm supposed to say Jai Prabhu, but I feel like saying something else. So what should I do? Should I say Jai Prabhu, or should I say something else? Well, if so thinking, the Guru has trained me to respond like this. Is that a facade? On one level it is, but on a deeper level, we're trained by Guru to respond in the way that the soul would. So if you're doing that, even though it's a little bit mechanical, and it feels hypocritical, on a deeper level, that is you. That is the way your soul would and should respond. So that behavior, which is dictated by Guru's instructions, may seem a little hypocritical or unnatural because we're conditioned to respond in a different way. But if you do it, if you behave that way, then you become conditioned to interacting on spiritual principles. And that becomes natural because it is your nature all along. But some, they learn the linguistics, they learn the culture, they learn the rituals because they want to deceive. They won't make advancement. How to deceive? How to determine if the motive is deception or purification? By their fruits you shall know them.
So Bhikkhu was initially acting to deceive, and then her husband put her in a different mode to want to get. Did she want to get purified, or she still wanted to do the same thing?
Both. She wanted both. But when the process of bhakti and the process of material conditioning confront one another, bhakti is more powerful. As long as that's what we want. Because Krishna ultimately fulfills it. So she had both. She had conditioned desires as well as pure desires. So her husband engaged in the process which would cultivate the higher desires. Which would, it's like, what's a good agricultural field? One which is free of weeds?
It has living organisms.
One which is full of bountiful grains or crops. They crowd out the weeds. You can't have a field that's just plain free of weeds. Something's going to grow there. So it's your choice what you're going to grow, what you're going to cultivate. If you don't cultivate anything, then the weeds take over. If you cultivate a rich, healthy crop, then the weeds don't have a chance. Actually, Srila Prabhupada used that analogy of a paddy field. He said the heart's like a paddy field. It's like an agricultural field. So he used the analogy of rice, like the Bhakti Lata Bija. Rice grows underwater. And as long as the rice is underwater, it flourishes. If the paddy field becomes dry, then the weeds that are in the soil, they take over and crowd out the rice. So you got to keep your heart flooded with the nectar of devotion. And then the weeds can't, they're there, they're dormant in seed form, but they can't grow in the environment of that nectar, which is like the water is to the rice. But if the dike breaks, but you don't replenish it, and it gets dry, and then it starts to crack, and then it won't hold water even if you put it in. So it requires, you know, continually hearing the Bhagavatam and rendering service, all things that are troublesome to the heart are practically destroyed, and loving devotional service to the Lord, whose eulogies and prayers and hymns is established as an irrevocable fact. So it's a continuous process. You can't, you know, base your success or failure on just a few days of practice. But, you know, generally it's not one or the other. It's both. In the conditioned soul, it's both a sincere desire to be purified along with a little bit of desire to deceive. But there again, in relationships, you got a choice of which one you're going to cultivate. The higher one or the lower one. It's a lot tremendously based on by your own interactions and your own responses. Therefore, you got to, you know, train and exercise the higher self to get control and dominance over the lower self. And conditioning works in a good way too. Condition the higher modes and condition the transcendental modes. We're creatures of habit.
So then it's in perception. How, like, if someone's acting that way to you, you can choose to perceive them as being hypocritical and looking at it in that way as a fault, or you can perceive them that they're struggling.
And they're sincere and they're struggling.
Right.
And which is right and which is wrong? They're both right. But the one that's going to become reality is the one you focus on and the one you respond to. Because that's what you're, you know, the exchange is what gives life. So what are you exchanging with? The exchange with lower modes and lower desires, that's what you're making stronger. Where you're exchanging and interacting on the higher level, which brings out the best. That's what we need to do. It's inspiring devotees. And even if it's just like some tiny spark of goodness and a whole blazing fire of lust, well, if that's what you focus on, that's what you interact with, that's what's going to take dominance in the long run. So patience has to accompany perseverance to bring about results.
Like Kasyapa, he could have, when his wife said that, criticized her.
Just imagine, in today's world, some, you know, standard husband or wife, and the husband's so pleased by the wife's behavior, I will give you whatever you want. So, I want a child who can kill President Bush. There's a lot of husbands that would be delighted with who I desire. But what is that going to do for anybody? He's going to get another demon. You know, maybe the greater or lesser of two evils, but it's all evil anyway, so why go there? Yeah, plenty of them would be delighted. Yeah, I'll go with that. What does that accomplish? Rotating about in lower modes of samsara. How about a son who can please Srila Prabhupada? Okay, well, there's a certain procedure that'll bring about that result. And that's what we want to choose. And ultimately, you know, we talk about children, it's got a lot to do with your own consciousness, what you're cultivating in your own heart and giving birth to. We want to give birth to Krishna consciousness in our hearts. So we follow the etiquette. Achieve that goal. Thank you very much. All glory to Srila Prabhupada.
Thank you.
Well, that's
in your class today?
Yeah.
I look like some kind of women's story or something.
No.
I don't want to do a budget.
Because they want to hear your class.
No, something.
No. I'll be right back.